something that really intrigued me is all women like this. They're different, and it roused me to. I get a hard on sometimes, mm-hmm. and it was the only time I had an opposite sex in class. Everybody's clothes and stuff like that. This was a woman that was sometimes laying down with no bra on. I mean, you couldn't see anything but bare skin. It was a turn on in a way, and I enjoyed looking out the window at her when she wasn't watching.
Did Mom enjoy that?
She didn't even know I was there. No, she was down just doing sunbathing, and then she'd turn over. Before she turned over, she always fastened her bra and turned over and. Maybe a little bit up here to show because no tan marks.
Welcome back to the Rainy Day Horror Show. I'm Big Daddy D. You're listening to the number one podcast on the internet. And on today's beautiful little episode, we are going to be continuing and ending the Green River Killer Serial Killer Sunday episode. So, without further ado, I am going to introduce your host for this evening's show, Dusty McBalls, aka the Certified Cooper Hunter, and your host with the most. Now sit back, shut up, and enjoy this episode.
Thank you, Big D, for that beautiful little intro. And yes, like he said, we are hopefully going to officially end the Green River Killer. You know, if I'm being honest, I didn't think this was going to be a three-part series, okay? I thought I was just going to be maybe two at most. But this shit is just, it's so much. There's so much information on this dude, and I want to cover everything for you guys. So, it's going to be a long episode. We're going to jump right into it. Not really much of an intro or anything. We're just going to go right in and fucking do this thing. Alright? So, kick those Crocs on, and let's go on an adventure. Now, I'm trying to remember where we left off. I think I have the right part, and if this isn't the right part, it's going to look really fucking weird, because there's going to be like this huge jump to something else, but that's okay, we're rolling with it, we're having fun, we're letting loose. Hold on, sorry, I gotta get my notes in order here. Alright, here we go. In January of 1984, the Green River Task Force came under a new leadership that was now headed by Captain Frank Adamson, who previously headed the police department's internal affairs unit. Now, if you don't remember, they were having a lot of issues with this new, what is it? This investigation. They weren't getting anywhere, okay? They needed something, right? And I know in the previous episode, I said that I think it was Keppel. He came up with new ideas and changes that needed to be done within this task force. So,
with this new captain coming into the task force, they're about to make some new changes. Now, during the first few months of Adamson's new assignment, drastic changes did take place. He first decided that it would be in the investigation's best interest to relocate the task force headquarters to the Buren County Precinct. Sorry to my Washington folks if I butchered that. I apologize. Which was near the airport, and it was also closer to where most of the crimes at this point were taking place. Also, following Keppel's advice, Adamson divided up various tasks and assigned them to individuals within the new team. Well, not really the new team, but the team that is tackling this Green River Killer case. Now, it was believed that this new method would facilitate a more thorough organization and integration and assemblage of the vast amounts of information, and would hopefully lead to a more successful result within this case. Now, in Smith and Guillen's book that they made, remember, second episode, I believe, first or second episode, the two authors that made this book about the Green River Killer, they stated that one team composed of seven investigators and one sergeant or team leader was assigned to handle the victims of the Green River Killer. And then the other team was of a similar construction with several investigators and a sergeant or team leader. And the other team was assigned to information pertaining to the suspects. Adamson then assigned three detectives to a newly constructed crime analysis section whose duties involved the follow-up of leads and to analyze any possible trends or methodologies utilized by this killer, as well as their information relevant to the case. 22 police officers were also assigned to the Task Force Proactive Squad, which developed new strategies to monitor prostitute activities on the strip and any unusual events or suspicious persons in the area. However, a new strategy was imposed by Keppel that changed the investigators' focus from the suspect's possible guilt to the suspect's possible innocence. The implication of this strategy would allow investigators to quickly eliminate people under suspicion who had alibis instead concentrate on more probable suspects, so they won't be wasting time on people that didn't really matter. Now, the suspects that remained were prioritized according to their threat, which this meant those who were most closely linked to the victims and fit the profile of the killer along with his movements, they were all put in Category A. And those who were less closely linked with the crimes were assigned to categories B or C before eventually being eliminated. Now, just when it seemed as if the newly built task force was better prepared for this case and ready to capture the Green River Killer, tragedy struck again, like it has this entire series. On February 14th, 1984, the skeletal remains of a woman who was later identified as Denise Louise Plager was discovered 40 miles from Seattle near Interstate 90. She was the first victim to be found that year, but not the last victim that was found that year. Over the next 2 months, approximately 9 more bodies were found. Some of those included to be Cheryl Wims, who was 18, Lisa Yates, who was 26, Debbie Abernathy, and Terry Milligan, who were both 16, Sandra Gabbert, who was 17, and Alma Smith, who was 22. Now, the other victims remained unidentified. Most of the girls had one primary thing in common, just like with most of these victims up until this point. They all had a history of prostitution. Now, it had appeared as if the Green River Task Force was making few advances in this investigation, but distinct patterns began to emerge that allowed the team to create a more accurate profile of the killer and his movements. The killer seemed to have several dumping grounds where he would dispose of the bodies of his victims. With the exception of Meehan, the bodies that were discovered were found partially buried or covered with garbage or foliage. Most of the bodies had been found off of isolated roads in or near illegal waste dumping areas. The FBI's profiler John Douglas concluded that the bodies were dumped in the areas because the killer thought of the women as human garbage, which is true. I'm just kidding, women. I just wanted to piss you off a little bit. I apologize. I'm sorry. I take it back. We love you. Well, I love you. Especially if you're a cougar. Certified cougar hunter. Amen. Preach, brother. Now, during the 1983 dumping grounds moved away from the river and concentrated mostly around the SeaTac Airport and Star Lake. But in 1984, the victims' remains were concentrated in the areas of Mountain View Cemetery and North Bend off of a near, or, sorry, not off of, or, let me rewind. North Bend off of or near to Interstate 90. The victims were also disappearing from two primary areas, the Strip and the downtown area of Seattle. The task force worked under the assumption that the killer worked or lived close to the area where he was disposing of these bodies. The task force also determined that the areas where the bodies were found, when plotted on a map, roughly formed a triangle, and it was believed that the killer might live somewhere within that triangle. Another important discovery was also made in April of 1984 when the skeletal remains of some of the victims were found. There happened to be shoe impressions near the bodies, and they assumed, the task force assumed, that maybe they were the foot impressions or the shoe impressions of the killer. And when this was revealed to them, it was slightly under this, it didn't give a name, I don't know what victim it was, but it was under a victim that, or not under, but near a victim that was partially covered by some brush. And upon furthering examining these footprints, investigators learned that they were made by a size 10 or 11 man's walking shoe. And this was probably the most, well, is the most vital piece of information up until this point in the investigation. Because remember, they didn't have anything. All they had was just the dumping grounds and the victims. They didn't have really anything else. So this was a huge break for them in the Green River Killer case. Now in mid-April, a volunteer task force worker and psychic, Barbara, or Barbara, Funny story, okay, about the name Barbara. My grandma's name is Barbara, right? When we went to Cancun a while ago, like 10 years ago, one of the waiters said her name as Barbara, so it's just like a running joke in my family, and it is so fucking funny. But Barbara Kubik Pattern had a vision that another woman's body would be found close to Interstate 90. Barbara immediately contacted the police and told them about her vision. But she became increasingly frustrated when they failed to act on the new information. So she decided to take matters into her own hands. And Barbara and her daughter set out to find the woman. Now, following the leads revealed by her vision, Barbara and her daughter eventually came across another body. And after they made this discovery, they immediately drove to a nearby search area that was being patrolled by police. And Barbara basically told them everything that she had found. And she was kind of thrown for a loop here because they didn't believe her, and the police even threatened her with an arrest for obstruction of the guarded perimeter. And this pissed Barbara off. So what did she do? She decided to go be a badass bitch and decided to go to the reporters that were nearby the area and just started talking to them. And as she was talking to them, finally, the members of the task force approached her and they asked her to show them where the body was. And shortly after she showed them, the police were confronted with this gruesome discovery. And they ended up finding the decomposing remains of Amina Igashev, who was 36 at the time that her body was found and dead and disappeared, right? She was last seen on July 7th, 1982, and she was walking home from her work at a restaurant in downtown Seattle. Igashev did not fit the description of many of the Green River Killer's victims. She was older than the other victims and was a waitress, not a prostitute. Igashev was also in a stable relationship at the time of her disappearance and was a mother of two. Although there were obvious differences between Igashev's lifestyle and those of the other victims and the location of where her body was disposed of, investigators believe that she was the victim of the Green River Killer. And she also was listed as one of the Green River Killer's first victims, even though several murders prior to her disappearance matched the modus operandi, or the MO, of the killer. Fast forward, let me back up a month. Fast forward a month to May 26th, when two children were playing on Jovita Road in Pierce County. They also ended up discovering a skeleton. The police and task force were immediately called and they decided to go retrieve the corpse like they usually do. Now, following a medical examination, it was discovered that the remains were that of a 15-year-old runaway who was named Colleen Brockman. Investigators still had no new leads to identify the killer apart from the location of the bodies and the shoe print. And almost after three years, the murderous killing spree continued. Which brings us to this pivotal moment in our case, or our episode, right? You'll see what I mean here in a second. Following the discovery of Brockman and the murders, they didn't stop. They really didn't. I mean, they stopped a little bit, but not. They were still continuing. And the task force still had this huge, like, it was still their top priority to catch this killer, even though they were, the killings were slowly starting to die off. And in August of 1984, investigators believed that they finally caught a big break in the case when two criminals arrived in a San Francisco jail that actually confessed to the Green River murders. So the investigators went to San Francisco and interviewed the two prisoners, but they were able to figure out that these two convicts were lying and that they weren't actually the Green River Killer or killers. Then several months later after that incident, the infamous serial killer, Ted Bundy, offered from his prison cell on death row to assist Keppel and the task force in finding their man. He allegedly sent an 8-page letter to Keppel saying, "Let me help you out. I got this. Let me in there like swimwear, all right?" Bundy offered his old antagonist a rare glimpse into the mind of a serial killer, an offer that Keppel could not refuse. The two men conversed mostly over letters, and Keppel was able to ask very detailed questions, hoping that Bundy would answer them. And much of the information that Keppel received actually helped him out a lot. And he was basically, Ted Bundy was saying that this killer doesn't care about anybody but himself. He hates his family. He's very, very full of himself and cocky, and he's taunting you guys with these murders. And he even said, allegedly, I couldn't back this up. I only had one source that said it, and I tried to see if it was true, and I couldn't find anything, so take this with a grain of salt. But I also read that Ted Bundy told the investigators to stake out the crime scene areas after they find a body because Ted Bundy believes that the killer will return to, you know, have sex with a dead corpse. Allegedly. I don't know. I could only find one source that said that, and I couldn't find anything to back that up. So, Bundy suggested that the killer also knew his victims and probably even befriended them before he lured them to their deaths. Now, according to Keppel's book, The River Man, Bundy suggested that the killer likely disposed of even more bodies where they found the more recent ones. However, he believed the disposal pattern of the bodies led closer to the killer's home. Now, Bundy was able to give a very helpful yet unusual insight from a killer's perspective, much of which was very helpful in this case. The information received from Bundy assisted the detectives in their general understanding of serial killer behavior. And in fact, Bundy became one of their primary consultants next to Douglas and Keppel that contributed to the buildup of this killer's profile. Now, despite the unusual advice, the task force remained... they had a roadblock, and they still couldn't identify the Green River Killer. Although the murders seemed to have slowly diminished over time, they did not cease altogether, like I said earlier. Between October and December of 1984, two more bodies who are identified as Mary Sue Bello, who is 25, and Martina Authorly, who is 18, were discovered. Both bodies were found off of Highway 410, and this brought the victim level disappearance death thing to 31 people. Although only 28 of the victims actually made it onto the quote-unquote official Green River Killer murder list, and 14 women were still believed to be missing at this point. Then, on March 10th, 1985, another partially buried body was found near Star Lake Road. The victim was eventually identified as Carrie Royce, who was 15 at the time of her disappearance. Well, yeah, at her disappearance, and she disappeared during the summer of 1983. Then again, in mid-June of 1985, a man bulldozing a patch of land in Tigard, Oregon, discovered the skeletal remains of two more women. The remains were later identified as Denise Bush, who was 23 years old at the time of when her body was found, and Shirley Sherrill, who was 19. Both girls were known prostitutes in Seattle, and the discovery of the two women confirmed the fact that the Green River's killers, basically area of murder and dumping bodies, extended out of state. And it seemed as if a new dumping ground had been revealed, which I think would be like 6 or 7. Are we already at like 7 new dumping grounds for this series? Which is, that's just fucking insane. That is so much. Like, who has the fucking time to do that? Who has the fucking time to do that? That fucking blows my mind. That blows my fucking mind. Now, while all of these bodies were being found, FBI profiler John Douglas re-evaluated the previous profile of the killer and came to a new conclusion and a new theory that kind of took this case in a different direction. Mr. Douglas suggested that there were two separate killers. Although the profiles of both killers were similar in many ways, the way in which they disposed of the bodies was slightly different. To Douglas, it seemed as if one of the killers went to greater effort to conceal the bodies than the other, whereas some bodies were partially covered or buried in isolated areas, other bodies laid openly and exposed to detection, such as those that were found in the Green River. Now, even though this theory seemed plausible at the time, there were no suspects available that could support his theory. The case had run cold, and no likely suspects could be connected at this point with any of the murders. And because of this, it put so much pressure onto the task force for its lack of ability to capture the killer, or in this case, killers, from after basically 3 fucking years. And it wasn't until the winter that the skeletal remains of yet 3 more victims were fucking found. The first remains were identified as those belonging to Mary West, which were found in a wooded area in Seaward Park in Seattle. And the 2 other remains were that of Kimmy Kai Pitzer and another unidentified white female between 14 and 19 years old. The unusual aspect of this more recent discoveries was that Pitzer's remains had been located in 2 different locations. In December of 1983, her skull was discovered in Mountain View Cemetery, and 2 years later, the remainder of her body was found a short distance away in a ravine. Now, their theory for possibly why she was found in 2 different areas was that an animal dragged the skull from the body sometime after she had died. But there was no evidence to suggest that this actually happened. The police believed it was the work of the killer. Investigators were certain as to the killer's motive for dividing the body between the 2 different locations. They speculated that it was done to taunt the police or confuse the investigation. Fast forward a couple months. In February of 1986, the Green River Task Force seemed to get a break that it was hoping for. A man described by investigators as a POI, or person of interest, was brought into the police station and searched. The event received a great deal of media attention, and FBI agent and Detective Jim Doyon of the task force extensively questioned this new suspect. However, before long, they realized he was not the man that they were looking for, and he was shortly released. Now, during this time, the public became increasingly aware of the task force lack of results. Thus far, there had been several suspects taken into custody, and each one proved to have no connection with the murders. And this basically brought a boiling point in the public with just a bunch of anger and fear. And the media started to refer to the Green River Task Force as a joke. And to make matters even worse, that summer, the skeletal remains of three more women were discovered off of I-90 east of Seattle. The remains were those of Maureen Feeney, who was 19, Kim Nelson, who was 26, and another unidentifiable young woman. Feeney was the only one of the three that investigators were able to link to a career in prostitution. The number of victims was quickly climbing toward a staggering 40 people that have been murdered. By the end of 1986, the staff had been reduced by 40%, and Adamson was reassigned to another project. Captain James Pompey became the new leader of the Green River Task Force. Pompey immediately began to reorganize the team and the data related to this investigation. And just as Pompey was beginning to get started, two more bodies were discovered in December. This time, the bodies were found much further away than expected in an area north of Vancouver, British Columbia. Yet again, investigators started to think that, like, he's taunting us. The killer is fucking taunting us. And even more intriguing about this case was that the partial remains of several other women had been scattered alongside the bodies of these two women. Even though the bodies were located at great distances from the others, there was no doubt within these investigators that the work that had been committed here was that of the Green River Killer. Now let's move into 1987. And in the beginning months of 1987, investigators had a new suspect in relation to the Green River murders. Previously known to police, the newest suspect had been picked up for attempting to solicit an undercover police officer posing as a prostitute in May of 1984. However, the man was released after successfully passing a lie detector test. And when the investigators looked deeper into this man's past, they discovered that he had been accused of choking a prostitute in 1980 near the SeaTac International Airport. And when he was brought in for questioning on that situation, he claimed it was self-defense after allegedly, quote-unquote, allegedly saying the woman bit him. And because of that, he was soon released after he was put in police custody. Now, one of the task force detectives, Matt Haney, was highly suspicious of this suspect and decided to dive even further into the man's history. he discovered that the police had at one point stopped and questioned the man back in 1982 while he was in his truck with a prostitute. The investigator learned that the prostitute he was with was one of the women on the Green River murder list, Kelly McGinnis. However, the police approached the man again in 1983 in connection with the kidnapping of murder victim Marie Malvar, a witness Malvar's boyfriend. That's the witness, sorry, I worded it weird. Followed the truck to the suspect's house after recognizing it as one of... Whoa, let me rewind. After recognizing it as the one that he last saw his girlfriend get in, Haney believed he might be onto the Green River Killer. And he was. Haney learned from the man's ex-wife that he often frequented the dump sites where many of the bodies had been discovered. Also, several prostitutes claimed to have seen a man matching the suspect's description regularly cruising the strip between 1982 and 1983. It turned out that the man passed the strip almost daily on his way to work. Some of the most damaging evidence discovered was that the man, who worked as a truck painter, was found to have been absent or off duty on every occasion a victim disappeared. Finally, on April 8, 1987, the police obtained a search warrant and searched the man's house. According to the Seattle Times, the police also took bodily samples of the suspect so that they could compare them with the evidence they had from the Green River victims. However, there was insufficient evidence to arrest him, and the man was released from police custody. That suspect was identified as Gary Ridgway. And the reason that they had to let him go was because they didn't have the technology at the time to do a thorough job with the sample, the semen sample. That's what it was. Technology just wasn't readily available yet. But don't worry. Don't worry. It comes back, okay? Now, several weeks following Ridgway's release, ironically, kind of creepy, it's really, really fucking creepy, Captain Pompey died from a massive heart attack related to a scuba diving incident. The unfortunate event was picked up by the media and it blew the fuck up. And a lot of conspiracies came with it. It suggested that the Green River Killer was actually a police officer that murdered Pompey, regardless of the fact that there was absolutely no substantiating evidence to support this theory. One newspaper even called for an official investigation into the death of Pompey. It seemed as if the public's nerves were getting all up in a tizzy. I don't know what the fuck that was. Burped but inhaled at the same time and it fucking got caught in my throat. That was fucking weird. But yes, it's just the public is getting really on edge with all of this shit and they're so fucking upset because so many people are dying within their community. And this just really kind of pushed them over the edge. Now the task force, which was now led by Captain Greg Boyle, because Pompey died, was called once again in June. Three boys stumbled across the partially buried skeletal remains of a young woman while searching for aluminum cans. Or aluminium if you're a UK weirdo. Sorry, I love you guys in the UK. Just feel like giving you shit. The girl who was identified was Cindy Ann Smith, and she was 17. And she was found in a ravine behind the Green River Community College. she had been missing for approximately 3 years before her discovery. And after that, more bodies of missing young women were discovered in the year that followed, some of which included that of missing runaway Debbie Gonzalez, who was 14, and Deborah Estes without the testes, who was 15, who disappeared 6 years earlier. Their deaths were attributed to the Green River Killer. Although there were still bodies being discovered, there were no recent killings attributed to the Green River Killer in the Seattle region. Now, when 1988 hit, the discovery of more than 20 bodies of prostitutes in San Diego led to the belief that the Green River Killer moved and continued his murderous rampage in California. Detective Reichart and the new task force commander Bob Evans temporarily joined forces with the San Diego Police Department in an effort to find the killer. And in December of 1988, investigators had a new suspect. And this new suspect was a man named William J. Stevens, who caught the attention of the police after several callers phoned him in as a potential suspect during the airing of the popular true crime detective show, Crime Stoppers. Stevens was a prison escapee who was on the run for 8 years, after a 2-year stint behind bars for burglary. At the time he was rediscovered by police, he was enrolled at the University of Washington as a pharmacology student. Now, as the task force investigators delved into Stevens' past, they learned that he was already a suspect in the Green River killings. It was also learned that Stevens had a blatant hatred for prostitutes and was known to have on several occasions talked about murdering them. When police searched his home, they found massive amounts of firearms, several driver's licenses, credit cards that were assumed names, and sexually explicit nude photos of the toots, the prostitutes. Stevens was highly involved in robbery and credit card fraud, which he used to basically get by and live his life. Task Force investigators exhaustively interviewed Stevens about the Green River murders and searched the premises of his home throughout the summer and fall of 1989. Investigators even searched Stevens' father's home for clues trying to tie him to any of the murders. However, nothing was found that could link him to the murders. Moreover, credit card records and photographs produced by Stevens' brother provided a tight alibi against his involvement with the crimes. According to the numerous records and receipts, Stevens was traveling across the country during the summer months of 1982 when many of the murders occurred. Eventually, Stevens was cleared of all involvement in the Green River murders. But just later that year, in October of 1989, two more skeletal remains of young women were found. One of the victims, who was identified as Andre Childers, was found in a vacant lot near Star Lake and 55th Ave South. Like many of the young women found before her, the cause of death remained unclear due to the state of decomposition. In early February of 1990, the skull of Denise Bush was found in a wooded area in Southgate Park in Tukwila, Washington. The remainder of Bush's body was located in Oregon, 5 years earlier. Once again, it seemed as if the killer was purposely moving the bones around in an effort to confuse investigators And according to the Seattle Times, in July of 1991, the task force was reduced to just one investigator named Tom Jensen. And after 9 years, roughly 49 victims and $15 million, the task force still had not caught the Green River Killer. The investigation became known as the country's largest unsolved murder case, and the case remained dormant for 10 more years. And because of the reducing of all of this, these officers, the morale became very low, and they didn't think that they were going to get this killer. But they were. And they did. In April of 2001, almost 20 years after the first known Green River murder, Detective Reichardt, who had become the sheriff of King County, began to basically reopen the investigation and look into the murders. And it was a case that he allegedly, according to the sources, it was a case he refused to let go of, and he remained determined to find the killer. This time the task force had technology on their side. Reichardt formed a new task force team, initially consisting of 6 members, including DNA and forensic experts and a couple of badass detectives. And it wasn't long before the force grew to more than 30 fucking people. All the evidence from the murder examination was re-examined, and some of the forensic samples were sent to the labs. Here we go. It's time. It's time to dance and get all up in the oogie boogie. He's getting fucking caught. We're doing this shit right now. The first samples to be sent to the lab were found with 3 victims that were murdered between 1982 and 1983. Those victims were Opal Mills, Marcia Chapman, and Carol Christensen. The samples consisted of semen supposedly taken from the killer. The semen samples underwent a newly developed DNA testing method and were compared with samples taken from Ridgeway in April of 1987. And on September 10th, 2001, Reichardt received news from the labs that reduced the hardened detective to tears. There was a match found between the semen samples taken from the victims and Ridgeway. And on November 30th, Ridgeway was intercepted by investigators on his way home from work and was arrested on 4 counts of aggravated murder. The charges included that of the 3 girls and also Cynthia Hines, in which circumstantial evidence was also found connecting him with her. The man that investigators had sought out for 20 years was finally in police custody, and they didn't let him go. And get this. Hold on, I gotta find it. I'm looking for it real quick. Give me 2 seconds. And get this, okay? At the time that he was arrested, he was married to Judith Mawson, and she did not know anything about the Green River Killer or his crimes at that point. And she was absolutely stunned when she heard the detectives and the case when it went public, when people were talking about his long history of rape, murder, and necrophilia. And when she was interviewed by reporters, Mawson said that Ridgeway was the perfect husband and had always treated her like a newlywed, even though they've been together for 17 years. Holy shit. That is just incredible. That's fucking incredible. 17 years he was able to keep this act up. That's mind-blowing. Like, I know some people, they can fucking do it, but, like, you know how stone cold you have to be? And, like, I would feel, like, void of emotion, right? Like, void of regret and, like, just, like, oh my god, I did something wrong, I'm gonna get caught. Just, like, all that out the fucking window, right? That is fucking crazy to me. She also said, well, okay, let me backtrack. He claimed that he truly loved Mawson. And according to the timeline of his murders, his kill rate went down after they had gotten married. But shortly after he was convicted, well, not convicted, but caught, Mawson filed for divorce after his confessions and later said that she felt like she had saved lives by being his wife and making him happy. And let's get to the trial. In early August of 2003, Seattle Television News reported that Ridgway had been moved from a maximum security cell at King County Jail to an undisclosed location. Other news reported stated that his lawyers, led by Anthony Savage, were closing a plea bargain that would spare him the death penalty in return for his confession to a number of Green River murders. On November 5th, 2003, Ridgway entered a guilty plea to 48 charges of aggravated first-degree murder as part of a plea bargain that was agreed upon in June that would spare him execution in exchange for his cooperation in locating the remains of his victims and providing other details related to the murders. Now, in his statement accompanying his guilty plea, Ridgway explained that all of his victims had been killed inside King County, Washington, and that he had transported and dumped the remains of the two women near Portland to confuse the police. Deputy Prosecutor Jeffrey Baird noted in court that the deal contained the names of 41 victims who would not be the subject to the state versus Ridgway if it were not for the plea agreement. King County Prosecuting Attorney Norm Malang explained his decision to make this deal, and he said, "We could have gone forward with 7 accounts, but that is all we could have ever hoped to solve. At the end of the trial, whatever the outcome, there would have been lingering doubts about the rest of these crimes. This agreement was the avenue of the truth. And in the end, the search for the truth is still why we have a criminal justice system. Gary Ridgway does not deserve our mercy. He does not deserve to live. The mercy provided by today's resolution is directed not at Ridgway, but toward the families who have suffered so much." Then, on December 18th, 2003, King County Superior Court Judge Richard Jones sentenced Ridgway to 48 life sentences with no possibility of parole and one life sentence to be served consecutively. He was also sentenced to an additional 10 years for tampering with evidence for each of the 48 victims, adding 480 years to his 48 life sentences. Holy shit. Holy shit, that's fucking crazy. That is fucking crazy. I think that is the biggest sentencing or conviction that we've had on this channel. That is a lot. That is so much. Holy shit. After he was sentenced, Ridgway led prosecutors to three bodies in 2003, and on August 16th of that year, remains of a 16-year-old female found near Enumclaw, Washington, which was 40 feet from State Route 410, were pronounced as belonging to Pammy Annette Avent, who had been believed to be a victim of the Green River Killer. The remains of Marie Malvar and April Buttram were found in September, and on November 23, 2005, the Associated Press reported that a weekend hiker found the skull of one of the 48 women Ridgway admitted murdering in his 2003 plea bargain with King County prosecutors. The skull of Tracy Winston, who was 19 when she disappeared from Northgate Mall on September 12, 1983, was found by a man hiking in a wooded area near Highway 18 near Issaquah, sorry if I butchered that, southeast of Seattle. It's kind of a tongue twister if you think about it. It is. Right? I want to say Ridgway. But it's Ridgway, and sometimes Widge comes. It's been a battle. Ridgway confessed to more confirmed murders than any other serial killer, and over a period of 5 months, police and prosecutors ran a bunch of interviews, and he confessed to 48 murders, 42 of which were on the police's list of probable Green River Killer murders, well, victims. On February 4th, 2004, county prosecutors began to release the videotape records of Ridgway's confessions, and in one taped interview, he told investigators initially that he was responsible for the deaths of 65 women, but in another taped interview with Reichardt on December 31st, 2003, Ridgway claimed to have murdered 71 victims and confessed to having sex with them prior to killing them, and a detail in which he did not reveal until after his sentencing. In his confession, he acknowledged that he targeted prostitutes because they were easy to pick up and that he hated most of them. He also confessed that he had sex with his victims' bodies after he murdered them, but claimed he began burying the later victims so that he could resist the urge to commit necrophilia. Ridgway talked to and tried to make his victims comfortable before committing the murders, and in his own words, "I would talk to her and get her mind off the sex. Anything she was nervous about. And think, you know, she thinks, oh, this guy cares, which I didn't. I just want to get her in the vehicle and eventually kill her." Later in a statement, Ridgway also said that murdering young women was his career. Ridgway is incarcerated right now at Washington State Penitentiary in Walla Walla, Washington. But, you stingy motherfuckers, it doesn't stop there. It doesn't. It actually gets worse. It gets a lot worse. Because in 2011, a 49th body was found that was linked to Ridgway, which added yet another life sentence to his prison term. And 12 years later, in December of 2023 and January of 2024, two sets of remains were linked to the Green River Killer, and they were identified as 15-year-old Lori Ann Ratzpotnick and 16-year-old Tammy Lyles. And that, my beautiful friends, is the end of the episode. I'm sorry if I seemed monotoned during this episode or boring. Not gonna lie, I was kind of sick of the Green River Killer. Okay, just three fucking episodes, so much research, all right? It was fun, but I was just like, I don't know why I decided to go so in-depth when I was writing the script, but I was just like, bro, we need to chill out on this shit. But there you go, the Green River Killer. one of the most notorious serial killers in U.S. history, but I heard there is one that is way worse than him. Way worse. One that we may come across here shortly. That man is Samuel Little. I actually don't know who that is. I know nothing about that guy, so we'll probably end up doing him here soon. If he's from the state that I think he's from, which I think he is, if I do remember correctly. I don't fucking know. So, I'm going to change up the uploading schedule. I know, I change it up a lot. But I know you guys that listen to me probably also listen to other podcasts. And I release so much content that I don't want you guys to like miss it or anything like that. And I know sometimes, you know, you guys get busy. Trust me, when I listen to my podcast, I miss some of my favorite guys while I'm listening to another person's podcast. So I understand. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to either release them all on one day, or I'm going to release like half in the beginning of the week and like half at the end of the week. So you guys can, you know, kind of know what's going on here. So just because, and it also gives me more time to fully like edit some of these videos. Like I want to bring life, more life into these episodes. And it's just, I feel like it's been a little bit bland lately. All right. So we're just going to get through this week. And then we are going to, then I'm going to start just doing half and half or all in one day. And then I'll just edit throughout the week and record throughout the week, so then I can, you know, do it that way. Because sometimes these deadlines give me anxiety, I'm not going to lie, and I don't know why. And I know I lied to you guys, right? Like, this episode was supposed to come out yesterday on Tuesday, but it's coming out today. So, yeah. I got to figure out a way that works best for us both, okay? So that's probably what I'm going to try and do for a little bit here. Some in the beginning of the week, some in the end of the week, and then we'll just see where it goes from there. So, I've got nothing else for you guys. My tattoo is itching the fuck out of me, and it's pissing me off. Blackout tattoos hurt, and the itching is way worse because there's so much fucking ink in one designated area, specifically my fucking fingers, and like shit's like, we use our hands all the time, so, like, I have shit rubbing against, oh, bro, it's driving me nuts, and I'm thinking about it, and it's itching way, way worse. I'm gonna blow a fuse. So I'm gonna let you guys go. Remember, stay frosty, stay foxy. Most importantly, the most important thing on this planet, stay safe, you beautiful peacocks. Washington, it's been so fucking long. It's been 3 weeks. I love you guys. All right, I'm kind of tired of you guys right now, but don't, I love y'all. Thank you for letting me do a beautiful serial killer from your state. Deuces.